Hello, everybody. Welcome to The Rest is History's first true bonus podcast of 2022. And Happy New Year. Happy New Year to you, Tom. This is the first time I've laid eyes on you since before Christmas.
And what a lovely sight it is.
It's a wonderful sight, actually.
Because we're actually recording this late in the afternoon. And I've got a solitary light on next to my computer. And I look like my face is a blaze of light. I look like an angel.
That's not the image I would have chosen. I thought I was thinking vampire, but there you go.
Or vampire or angel. I mean, the difference between them is fairly narrow. Can be.
So, yes. So, Tom, I mean, obviously, let's address the elephant in the room straight away. The last time I saw you, we were recording the 12 Days of Christmas. We were recording this ridiculous marathon of where basically I lived, dreamed, slept, ate and drank history podcasts for about 3 days while we recorded all these podcasts, which were your idea. And I thought it was a terrible idea, actually. And I remember you first mooting it and me. And to be honest, I think possibly the producers as well, hoping that you would forget about it. And that
it would
go away. No, you didn't.
And I agree. I mean, in the midst of it, I thought it was a terrible idea because we'd run out of time. We're running out of time.
Yeah.
Kind of Christmas, need to go shopping and everything.
Yeah.
We were both very ill.
Yeah, both have. Yeah.
Although not, I mean, kind of unfashionably, not with
COVID,
Omicron,
but just with very heavy colds.
Yeah. So I think we're absolute heroes for having done it.
Well, as you know, I was away a New Year in Cornwall. So I was
in
off
Mousel.
Twitter and I was off the Discord. And I thought to myself, at last, finally, I don't have to think about the rest is history for a few days. But every now and again, my phone would ping and it would be Tom Holland with sending me a screenshot of the iTunes history episodes chart in order to prove how right you were.
I know.
And how delighted you were at having crushed our rivals.
I'm such an awful person. And the thing is, Dominic, that you're so above that kind of petty.
Of course, completely above it. I take no pleasure from it at all.
No, but I accept your apology.
Yes. Well, I mean, you know, you were right and I was wrong.
And I'm not gonna go on about it.
Yes. Clearly not. Well,
yes.
I think it's fair to say that I got the impression that a lot of people quite enjoyed them. A lot of people on the Discord, a lot of Rest of History club members enjoyed them. And in fact, some enjoyed them so much that they really entered into the spirit of the 12 Days of Christmas, didn't they? So I'm thinking about you, Amy Mantravardi.
Yes.
You probably knew this was coming.
Amy, you have been the toast of the Rest is History WhatsApp group. And Dominic is now going to sing the version of the 12 Days of Christmas that you wrote. Take it away, Dominic.
I thought you were going to sing. I think we should alternate the lines, Tom. That seems the fairest way of doing it.
Okay.
You can start.
On the 12th day of Christmas, my true love gave to me
12 Muppets dancing,
11 accents chancing,
10 churches, no, 27.
9 Belgians rousing,
8 Persians gloating,
7 eunuchs screaming,
a 6 worth hooraying,
5 Athol stands,
4 months of unheard, that's UNHERD,
3 French jests,
2 left-wing Marxist historians,
and Tom Holland on Christianity. So that was...
I think we could have given that more oomph, to be honest. I think Amy was probably looking for more.
Christmas has come and gone. We're recording this on Epiphany when all the decorations have to come down. So, or do they? There's huge debate about that. I'm sure people will call us out on that. But traditionally, by and large, we take them down on Christmas. So it's difficult, actually, to get into the festive spirit.
Yeah. But, retrospectively. So were you on the Discord over the Christmas period, Tom? Were you surveying the club scene?
No, occasionally, but I was trying to spend time with my family.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah. Well, I wasn't trying to spend time with your family.
No, of course not.
So coming back and looking through the questions, so we missed some excellent questions, actually, Discord questions. Octave Ox, who I don't think has featured before. I don't think we've featured one of Octave's questions. Octave Ox on the Discord said, who would win in a medieval joust between Tom Holland and Dominic Sambrook and why? That is the question the podcast really needs to address. Do you have an answer?
I think you'd win.
Why?
You have more heft.
Oh, thanks.
So I think it's fair to say that if you're on a horse and you've got a lance,
you're taller, you've got a stronger reach, you've got a longer reach, haven't you?
I know, but I'd look like Don Quixote. I'd be a shambles. I'd be a kind of scarecrow in armor.
Are you a practiced horseman?
Do you know, I learnt to ride on Wimbledon Common because I was going to America, to the Wild West.
One of the Wombles?
Yeah. I didn't think the Wombles rode horses.
They didn't. They definitely didn't.
So I learnt before going
to the Wild West.
Yeah, because we were going to go riding out in the Wild West. So I had a crash course where I learnt to ride on Wimbledon Common. But it turns out that in America they ride in a different way.
They do. Yeah, they
do. So I got there and I had my very English way of laughing and they all mocked me.
Right. Oh dear.
Yeah. But I can ride. Yes, I can ride a horse.
What's the difference in the American and the what?
It's the way you hold the reins.
Oh, is that it? I mean, that's
yeah, basically.
It.
Yeah.
Okay. Well.
Plus they wear chaps.
Right. You probably would win because I'm not a practiced rider. I have been riding.
Yeah.
But
I've never ridden obviously with a lance.
No.
So
or in armor.
In armor. So I've no way how that would impact on my performance. Anyway, it's an interesting question. I guess there's really only one way to find out, isn't there?
Yes.
And that's
we should organise one. Well, the other so there's a whole load of things we should organise because Amy Mantravadi, who did that song, has also started a conversation on where listeners would take us should we come to their hometown or home area. So I know there's already somebody wrote a long thing about Birmingham. Also Louisville, Kentucky, Banbridge, Northern Ireland. Is that Banbridge? And Brooklyn. I've never been to any of those places. I've been to Birmingham, but not the other places. Have you been to Louisville or Brooklyn?
I've been to Brooklyn. I've got a friend who lives in Brooklyn.
Is it good?
It's very hipster. Yeah. It's kind of.
Somebody told me that it was a worse version of East London.
I think that's...
I don't want to offend...
Possibly East London's the worst version of Brooklyn.
Right.
There's a slight Brixton vibe.
Is there?
So it felt a slight kind of home away from home. But, you know, very interesting. I mean, the history of New York, very interesting.
Yeah,
which we should definitely do.
Well, we had lots of individual reflections about the 12 Days episodes.
Right, yes.
So, for example, we did that episode about Good King Wenceslas and the first Gilbert and Sullivan, which I think was the second 12 Days
one,
wasn't it?
Stephen's Day, Boxing Day.
And Jeannie... I completely agree with Jeannie. Jeannie said, I recommend watching Topsy Turvy. It was in rehearsal for 6 months, during which time Mike Lee, who was the director, sent the actors off to do research on Victorian habits and speech patterns as well as the characters they would be playing. They learned the mechanics of theatrical production in the 1880s. They did their own singing and the musicians played the instruments. Yeah, I think Topsy Turvy... We talked about Topsy Turvy a tiny bit.
We did, and I said I'd watch it, and then I didn't.
I think it's an absolutely brilliant historical... And you don't need to have the slightest interest in Gilbert and Sullivan. It's just a brilliant... It's one of those films that's actually... we were talking about this in our History and Cinema sort of show. It's one of those films that are actually quite rare, where it's set in, you know, an easily pastichable historical period.
But they're true to it.
But they're really true to it, partly because they don't play it, you know, with the sort
comedy of... moustaches and things.
I mean, they have got the comedy moustaches, but it feels very naturalistic.
Yeah.
It's a bit like, have you seen Mr. Turner? Good. Have you seen Mike Leigh's Mr. Turner?
No, I haven't seen that either.
See, that's brilliant as well. Timothy Spall again as JMW or JWM Turner. Is it JWM or JMW?
JWM is
JWM. Well, anyway, he's Mr. Turner, and it's absolutely fantastic. Again, because it's completely naturalistic, so you believe
that's very much his approach, isn't it?
Yeah, and it works actually. It really,
because he just gets them and they evolve their own dialogue. But
they
I
do.
Would imagine, obviously, that setting in the 19th century would add a
and they have these and they've worked out these elaborate backstories for their characters based on research, which then don't really make it into the film,
but provides bottom.
It does provide bottom. You're sort of conscious of the characters having a hinterland.
Yeah. Well, you certainly, because I've watched quite a lot of his, the ones set in contemporary world, enjoyed them. So I don't know why I haven't seen those two.
Yeah.
It's odd. They just kind of miss me. We've also got one from Velky Yusi. Just some feedback on St. Wenceslas. His name in Czech is Vaclav. Wenceslas is the Latinized form. He was a good man, but as a duke, he was so-so. So how many times do we see that in medieval history?
Yeah.
Henry VI, we're looking at you. Boleslav was a terrible man, but a great ruler.
Well, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah, we see that.
Ivan the Terrible.
Bohemia is still used as a regional term in the Czech Republic.
Yeah, but as a regional term, not as the name for the Czech Republic itself.
Czechia is a terrible name and a topic of great controversy in the Czech Republic.
But the Czech Republic is a bad name though, isn't it?
Isn't it? Yeah.
Because you wouldn't want to be the something republic. You need a better brand.
Unless you're the Roman Republic.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean,
that's
so.
Very, if you're the Roman Republic. Yes, or the Venetian true. Republic.
I suppose so, but people don't call the Venetian, didn't call the, don't they just call it Venice? The medieval
I think the Venetian Republic has, you know.
Has a good ring to it.
That's classy. I am the emissary. I am the ambassador of the Venetian Republic.
Well, sometimes you hear Americans talk about the Republic, or indeed French. So listeners will know of my stint as a language assistant in Provence in the 1990s. And I can remember a pupil coming into my class and saying, "The president of the Republic is dead." And it was actually, I was very excited because I thought they meant Chirac, who was president at the time. But they actually meant Mitterrand. They still called him the president of the Republic.
Like the Americans.
Yeah, exactly. But the president of the Republic, it sounded very grand. And I thought nobody would come into a classroom and say, "The Prime Minister of the United Kingdom is dead," about, you know, John Major or something, would they? No, I mean, they wouldn't say anything.
No, they wouldn't. I think the Czech Republic has a certain heft, but I think Bohemia is better.
Bohemia and Moravia, that's what they should call it.
Zois, thoroughly enjoyed the Nero Romans episode. Like, that's great response, Zois. Tom is quite right. This is an excellent, excellent response. Tom is quite right. Just leave it at that.
To feel that
post-Manzikert Byzantine history is a depressing ordeal, one of history's greatest what-ifs. Yeah.
Is that a what-if, though? I mean, do you think the Byzantine Empire had legs if they hadn't lost the Battle of Manzikert?
Well, it wasn't the loss of Manzikert. It was the loss of Manzikert combined with the
civil war that followed.
That then exploded and enabled the Turks to kind of infiltrate Anatolia.
But they were probably always going to be shafted in the Fourth Crusade, weren't they?
No. Because they would have had more.
Men. Yeah, Anatolia had always provided their sort of military base, hadn't it? So that
as long as they had Anatolia, they were a great power. Once they lost Anatolia, they were clinging on by their fingertips.
Yeah. Okay. Now, the Massacre of the Innocents. Paul O'Connor has sent us a long response on Discord about this. Paul says he understands, you know, why the massacre, you might think the Massacre of the Innocents sounds implausible, but we shouldn't reject it completely. We know that Herod liked a bit of slaughtering if it was to his advantage. We know that children weren't highly regarded, hence the incredulous reaction when Jesus referred to them in his ministry. And the population of Bethlehem would have been small. Therefore, it's plausible that to kill all the firstborn in Bethlehem, you might have only killed about 20 people. Now Paul says, in the overall scheme of things, nothing to get animated about. I mean, that's easy for you to say, Paul. So, Tom, what about this? Do you think it's possible that the Massacre of the Innocents could be rooted in historical fact?
I still think it's sacred history. And I have to say that I had a shocker on the Massacre of the Innocents because the parallel, as Tim Fasby-Burney, top vicar on the Discord, pointed out, is with Pharaoh trying to wipe out the boys that he
brought. Yeah, the firstborn. Yeah,
which put Moses in the bulrushes and all that kind of stuff. So I thought
I thought you did say that, Tom. You think you?
No,
did,
I didn't. I for some reason I had a absolute brain fade and compared it to the angel of the Lord killing the firstborn.
Right,
Egyptian firstborn. I don't know what I was thinking.
Okay,
it had been. You know, I guess that was our.
We'd probably done about 17. We'd done about 17 podcasts that day.
Yeah. So that's my excuse.
We had some great feedback to the podcast. It's funny doing these podcasts, isn't it? Because we had two very different subjects each time. So we had one podcast on the 29th of December, which was Beckett and the Wounded Knee Massacre. We got lots of feedback on both these issues. So Meg T talks about feeling moved and humble as a child in the 60s. Cowboys and Indians were still a big thing. I took it for granted. Cowboys were indeed goodies and Indians were baddies. I'm feeling ashamed of myself and my history teachers. I think that was actually still very much the case. I would say cowboys and Indians. I mean, I didn't really play cowboys and Indians. It was slightly old fashioned even in the 70s. But I definitely had a sense that Indians were the bad guys, probably until I saw Dances with Wolves.
Yeah, because it's scalping, isn't it?
And the
truth is that they if you got captured by the Apache or whatever,
yeah,
it wasn't good news.
Well, that's true, but
it's kind of ridiculous to sugarcoat that.
But that said, Tom, I mean, the story of the destruction of kind of...
Of course, you know, I mean, we absolutely accept that. But the whole, you know, there is jeopardy.
Yeah.
If you're, I mean, cowboys and Indians, the cowboys entered the West after the Native Americans.
Yes, of course. Cowboys aren't actually ever really fighting Indians.
So they were never really fighting each other.
No. Yeah.
The coming of the great cattle herds and the cowboys, they can do that because the buffalo have been wiped out. There aren't actually any Indians to fight cowboys. But the kind of the general idea that white Americans pushing westwards, going into Native American tribal areas. I mean, if you got caught, it wasn't fun.
Yeah. No, I'm sure that, of course, that's true.
If you read Blood Meridian, did we talk about Blood Meridian?
Yeah, we did. And did we talk about the historical fiction episode?
Yeah, because that is...
Drenched in blood.
And it opens with a description of a massacre of an army platoon by, I think, the Apache, which is just terrifying. I mean, the idea that there are necessarily goodies or baddies.
Mm.
You know, because in say the Apache, I mean, they are empire builders just as much as the white Americans are.
Or the Comanche, they're empire.
Or the Comanche, talk of even the Comanche more terrifying, empire. Aren't they? So, I think generally talk of goodies and baddies is generally more complicated.
Michael Campling had a really interesting point about the parallels between the ghost dance, which is the sort of the Indian kind of revivalist cult that involved with the Wounded Knee Massacre and the Boxer Rebellion in China a few years later, the idea of spiritual invulnerability against bullets.
But also Jesus.
Yeah, and both, I guess you'd argue, wouldn't you, that in both cases, as with the Taiping Rebellion in China, that basically Christianity has...
A kind of explosive effect.
Yeah, Christianity
it's
and
like
guns.
Kind of adding a chemical to...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And a sense of victimhood and having been oppressed and having your culture having been ripped away from you. I suppose those all play into both those kind of uprisings, if that's the right word. Now, we had loads of questions about Tolkien. There was a big... I'm always pleased to see lots of Tolkien chat. And lots of people are asking for book recommendations and so on. I think we were both saying, weren't we, on the Discord, Tom Shippey and John Garth, I would say, are the two great writers. Yep. Shippey is all about the sort of Tolkien's academic interests and where Tolkien gets all the names from and the language and all that. And John Garth is absolutely brilliant, I think, about Tolkien and the war. The First World War.
He's also got a great book on the real life places.
Yes,
that might have inspired places in.
In a lovely
and it's a very very handsome volume.
It's just behind. I've just in this room that I'm doing this from behind me. It's beautiful, isn't it? Because he does it by kind of landscape, and he takes the places in England Tolkien got his inspiration from. Now, Sergeant Musgrave, I love this. He says generally he's very happy to accept or at least consider. Tom's Everything is Christianity thesis. But oddly, actually, Sergeant Musgrave does not agree with you. Oh, what he doesn't agree with you about is that The Lord of the Rings is popular because readers have a kind of latent desire to receive a Christian message kind of without knowing it, a disguised Christian message. Do you want to take issue with Sergeant Musgrave?
I would answer with the sainted Amy Mantravadi. Tolkien's work is absolutely permeated by his Christian worldview, which seems to me absolutely unarguable.
Yeah.
Actually, it goes back to what we were talking about, cowboys and Indians, that the idea of there being good and evil, goodies and baddies, is a complicated, it's one that by and large, I think in the contemporary world.
Yeah.
People would be skeptical of. And I think that Tolkien's portrayal of a world of good and evil enables people to have that sense of what goodness would be like, to identify with goodness, to identify with forces of good fighting forces of evil that by and large in the kind of the theological dimension has faded. And that seems to me very much a kind of the genius of it is that it does get you on board with an idea that there is good and evil and you want good to win.
Okay, fine. But that's true of lots of popular 20th century fiction, isn't it? I mean, it doesn't have to be overtly Christian.
But it is indeed. In Tolkien's case. It's absolutely saturated in theological ideas and assumptions.
I buy that.
Idea of good and evil itself as a dividing line. I mean, ultimately it's a Zoroastrian idea, but it's, we have inherited that idea through Christianity.
Okay.
The idea of there being good and evil.
Well, people
and that
didn't...
in a sense that, you know, the earth is fall, the world is fallen,
yeah,
and that the middle earth, the world that is midway between heaven and hell,
mm-hmm,
is a stage in which the battle between good and evil can be fought, which is absolutely what Lord of the Rings is premised on.
Yeah.
Is a fundamentally Christian one. But nobody really would buy that. I mean, I don't think even, I mean, I've never heard that, you don't hear popes or bishops or preachers really frame it in that way. You certainly don't get it in fiction.
Hmm.
But you do, I mean, sorry, you certainly don't get it in kind of, you know, theological tracts or anything, because people don't read those anymore.
But you get it in
but
fiction.
But you do get it in fiction.
Well, it's obviously, you get it in, I mean, the most obvious sort of mainstream, very mainstream version of that is the light and the dark in Star Wars or Harry Potter or something like that, right? I mean,
yeah.
And you're saying those are Christian.
Yeah, but
so the Greeks, say the Greeks.
Well, kind of.
Did the Greeks have a sense of good, there being a Manichaean kind of struggle between good and evil?
No, their gods told lies.
Right. So that's why they don't have evil gods, as it were.
The categories of good and evil don't exist in ancient Greece.
This is a massive topic. Fascinating.
So
I'll tell you who did believe this, Tom. So I mean, no one will be surprised by your argument here, and nobody will be surprised with what I'm about to say. Margaret Thatcher was a great believer. So
she became an Anglican.
I think the Sunday Times in about 1983 in an interview, it always sticks in my mind because it's so unusual from a politician. She says, I'm in politics because I believe in the struggle between good and evil, and I believe that one day good will triumph. And
well, yes.
And, you know, it's just such an extraordinary thing for a British prime minister in a very secularised Britain to say, and unthinkable that, you know,
but I think
Harold
to
Wilson
Tony Blair, I think to a degree
that.
Tony Blair believed it as well.
But Tony Blair...
And he got tripped up by it.
Tony Blair, it's interesting, isn't it, the difference
between... I think
George
Bush did. I mean, we talked about
George
that
in
the 9/11 episode.
George Bush is in a completely different context. So in George Bush's context, you can say that and you don't necessarily stand out. Ronald Reagan said it, for example, talked about the evil empire and so on. So in the American, and Jimmy Carter would have said it. So in the American context, that doesn't seem unusual. In the British context, I do think it seems unusual. Margaret Thatcher says it and is unashamed about it. Tony Blair says it, or, well, he doesn't really say it, does he? He thinks it, but he feels he can't articulate it.
Well, so Dominic, I would agree with you. I mean, I can't imagine...
John Major saying that.
No, I can't imagine, but I was thinking more kind of Harold Wilson or...
Yeah, they're too worldly.
But I would say that oddly, even though it may seem that institutional Christianity is currently in decline in Britain, actually we've had a number of prime ministers who you absolutely could imagine talking about there being good and evil. Mrs. Thatcher, Tony Blair, Gordon Brown, Theresa May.
Yeah.
I reckon all of them actually... You could imagine them talking in those terms. It's interesting.
Well, they're the ones who, yes. So Gordon Brown and Theresa May, obviously, they have religious backgrounds. They're both children of churchmen, aren't they?
But what you don't tend to get is say, bishops talking in those terms.
No. That's so true.
You're much like, yes. You know. I mean, that's the thing.
That's the irony, isn't it?
And that, I think, is what Tolkien is... That's the power of Lord of the Rings.
Well, now we have...
It's tapping into that, you know, it's a distinctively, I guess, medieval idea.
Well, you certainly wouldn't get Church of England. So the Reverend Tim Vasby Burney, I believe, is now a member of the Rest Is History Club. So he may well be listening to this. And he can, and any other vicars who can contribute to the Discord chat and tell us whether they believe in good and evil.
Of course they do. But I think that they probably...
Oh, they're ashamed
to
say
so. Speak for them.
Do you believe in good and evil, Tom?
Sometimes and sometimes not.
Yeah, I don't really have a strong position on it, to be honest. I probably don't, actually.
No, I mean, I think you have to have some religious faith to believe in
it. I think just because I don't believe in good. I think we're all fallen. Anyway, this is getting into very...
We're spiralling
off. Yeah, we're going into very dark waters.
But talking of people who did believe in good and evil.
Yes, we've got yes.
We've got, this is a follow-up to the thing we did on the Emperor Karl I of Austria. And Dominic, did I mention that you got picked up by Eduard Habsburg?
Picked up?
Well, he said he disagreed with your take on it.
What does he think?
Warning you there. I don't know. Because I said I blamed it on you.
Oh, right. So he's an ambassador of some kind, isn't he?
He's the ambassador to he's the Hungarian ambassador to the Vatican.
Okay,
and he's coming on the show to talk about the Habsburgs.
Well, presumably he's a great admirer of Emperor Karl the First, is he?
I think he is. Yes, I think. He felt that you had been a little bit harsh on him. Oh, he said in your episode, you plural were harsh.
A man who neglected to wear a coat to his own coup. That's all I say of Emperor Karl.
Well, I blamed it all on you. Anyway, so on that theme, S.W. Jacobs, there's a fantastic story of when Ian Paisley, Northern Irish Protestant minister and political leader, protested a speech given by Pope John Paul II at the European Parliament. He had some sign denouncing the Pope as the Antichrist and was throwing Jack Chick tracts around.
What's that mean?
Jack Chick? I don't know. I don't know what that is. A few of the MEPs, including Otto Habsburg, took a strong objection to Paisley, and Habsburg ended up allegedly belting Paisley in the face. 1980s Europe, a Protestant leader denounces the Pope and gets attacked by the Holy Roman Emperor. That's an excellent story.
So I know this incident, and this did happen.
Did it? I'm so glad to hear that.
It was at the European Parliament, I think, and... Paisley, I think I may have seen a clip or heard a clip of him shouting about the Antichrist at it. And it is quite funny, to be honest. The thing is, I've actually met Otto von Habsburg, and I didn't know at the time.
How did you meet him?
So he came to, when I was a student at Oxford, he came to Oxford to give a talk, and I went. But the thing was, he was kind of just billed as an MEP. And afterwards, there was like a dinner, and I was at the dinner. And I spoke to him very briefly, but because he was only billed as an MEP,
you hadn't put two and two together.
And I didn't really know much about the Habsburgs.
Did you know his name?
Yeah, I knew he was called Otto, and he was kind of an elderly gentleman of kind of Central European ancestry
extraction.
Yeah, but it didn't occur to me that he was in fact the heir to the Habsburg.
I know, it's kind of like meeting, you know, the Byzantine emperor, isn't it?
And like not knowing who he was. Oh,
although I think the Palaiologoi, I think they're bankers in London.
Are they? Do they still exist?
Yeah, I think they do. Yeah.
I mean, imagine if you met one of them and you didn't put two and two together. Well, this is what happened to me with Otto von Habsburg, and it was a very sad.
So you didn't offer him your sword?
No, because I just associated him with the European Parliament. So I just, which is of course to British listeners, most British listeners. I mean, unless you've got very impassioned views on either sort of leave or remain side, the very words European Parliament don't
No, it doesn't conjure up the siege of Vienna.
No, they're just so boring. No. I just remember it as an incredibly boring evening. And he sort of all he talked a bit about the European Parliament, said, you know, do you have any ambition to enter the European Parliament, young man? And I was like, no. Oh, so, what a terrible story.
The European Parliament's loss is podcasting.
Exactly.
Here's one on the very last item we did, which was your choice, Pepys Fanatiques.
I love that. I love the Fanatiques.
And this is a great point from Kevin Milan, which I've also heard other people make. I just caught up with the January 6th episode and was struck by the parallels between the Fanatique and the mob that attempted a coup at the US Capitol on January 6th of last year. Absolute belief in their own virtuous cause, causing chaos far in excess of their numbers and so on. And yes, being rounded up and punished, but sadly, not sufficiently as harsh.
Well, Kevin,
so Kevin wants
hanging,
he wants
hanging drawing,
hanging,
court,
drawing, quartering.
Yes, that, well, that fellow who, you know, who was dressed as
the shaman.
Yeah. As you may know, Tom, he was incarcerated somewhere, and his mother complained that they didn't have, was it vegan food? Did you see this? His mental health was suffering because he's a vegan, and I think it is, and he's got various food intolerances, and the prison authorities were not supplying him with the requisite food. I mean, this is a bit like the Emperor Karl and his coat again. If you're going to attempt a coup, I think worrying about
Would he how would he cope with hanging himself by hooks from his nipple? Because that's what shamans do.
Yeah, I think you're overestimating his shamanic authenticity.
Well, that's a letdown.
And I don't see.
See, if he'd gone in and done that, suspended himself by his nipples, by hooks.
Yeah, well, he didn't, did he?
I'd have been impressed by that.
Yes, I think there are sort of slight parallels, aren't there, between the fanatiques and the sort of Trump? There's this just sort of sense
the
of
QAnon
of kind of getting into the
kind of absolutely mad, all the really mad conspiracy theory stuff.
But also getting into
thinking
the center
that Jesus is coming at any moment,
getting into the center of power, and then just sort of randomly rampaging about without a kind of, because that's what Pepys's fanatiques, the Fifth Monarchy men, seem to have done, is that they rampage through London for a bit, and then they go out and hide in some woods.
Well, presumably they're waiting for King Jesus to arrive.
I suppose. I don't actually know what their strategy was. So Ted Valance is going to come on the show in a couple of weeks to talk about the execution of Charles I. And he's...
Did you see him? He was on Twitter.
He was on Twitter.
You up on your Meghan Markle.
Well, I think he was entertained by the parallel between Thomas Fenner and Meghan Markle. I think he thought it was a good...
Who could fail to be entertained by that?
I think he thought it was a good parallel.
It was. I enjoyed it.
So, yes, did we do a podcast about the Trump insurrection? We didn't, did we?
No.
We'd sort of done a lot of Trump by then. I suspect he will give us more opportunities for podcasts in the years ahead. So
Maybe, yeah. Right. Well, so those were the 12 days of Christmas.
But we also released our History and Cinema podcast as a bonus.
So we did. Yes, so we did.
And we had a couple of questions about that. So C. Brogan Savage, who I met at the... I think we both met at the Podicon event. She listened to it again. Very commendable behaviour. And she had to pause momentarily to come onto the Discord and plant a question for you, Tom. As a fan of Westerns, what do you think of Young Guns?
I never watched it. It seemed wrong.
Do you have a favourite Western?
Well, do you know, the one that I've watched more than any other is, I'm ashamed to say, The Good, the Bad and the Ugly.
Oh. See, I was about to say... that you've slightly taken the wind out of my sails, because I was about to say my favourite Western is Once Upon a Time in the West. So we're clearly both...
I admire that deeply, but given the choice, I'd watch The Good, the Bad and the Ugly.
Would you? I think Once Upon a Time in the West is such a brilliant film. Because it's partly about the coming of the railroads. It's got...
But it's also about the Western itself.
It is.
As
about the myth of the West.
So many Westerns are.
Yeah. It's got a brilliant cast. Claudia Cardinale is in it, who I think is the best person who's ever lived.
But the casting's so good and counterintuitive. Anyway, Phil 32, surprised there wasn't a place for Zulu, a great film and reasonably historically accurate as well. And Phil thought, Dominic, that you would have had that one in.
Do you know, the funny thing is that Zulu...
Why do you plead? How do you plead on that?
I should have had it. Zulu in my household is a bit of a running joke, because whenever we suggest watching a film,
I always
say to myself, to the rest of my family, maybe this is the evening for Zulu. And they always turn me down.
Has Catherine ever let you watch it?
No. But I don't think that's for sort of ideological reasons. I think it's because she just thinks it would be a bit boring.
Has she ever seen it?
No. No.
It's good. It is a good film.
It's a very good film. But is it not? I don't know whether Zulu has been cancelled now, has it? Has it been cancelled? It must have been.
No, I don't think so.
Because I don't think in itself...
I mean, it's very respectful,
no, yeah. I mean, but I think it's because... I think it would be... You know, I wouldn't put it on at a kind of student union.
well,
we're going to be doing a
fancy... Exist to get crossed.
We're going to be doing a fancy dress screening of Zulu.
No, you wouldn't want to do that. But no, I think it's... I mean, as Phil says, it's reasonably historically accurate. But I'm aware that the last time I saw it, I was probably 18.
Yeah.
Or something.
Where they're singing their songs. I mean, that's incredible. That's just fantastic.
But the kind of the mutual respect.
Exactly.
Between attackers and defenders.
Exactly.
I should watch it.
I think we should do
and see if my antennae.
We should perhaps do a podcast about sort of fictions of empire. Yes, maybe cinematic and so on.
Yeah. Yeah, that'd be good.
Because I think, you know, I'm a great...
I've actually been to Rorke's Drift.
Have you?
Yes, I have. I went to years ago. Weirdly, I went to a literary festival in Durban, and we had a couple of days off, and I went on a trip to Rorke's Drift and Isandhlwana, which I'd never realised was so close. It's basically just the other side of the pass.
No, I didn't realise that either. That's interesting. See, I think that those fictions of the British in Africa are far more influential than people think. So many kind of...
King Solomon's Mines.
King Solomon's Mines and She.
She,
I mean, so many video games, for example... basically draw inspiration from, you know, and they don't even know they're doing it. And all the Indiana Jones films and all those kinds of things, they're just reiterations of Rider Haggard, but the people making them don't realise, I think, often.
Rider Haggard, quite an odd quite an odd character.
Yes, but a fascinating character, though. Anyway.
Well, let's something to...
You know, Rider Haggard, taking us back to an earlier subject, was Tolkien's favourite author when he was growing up.
I can believe that.
So yeah, King Solomon, when you I never realised that until I think I read it in John Garth's book. And once you see it, then you look at The Lord of the Rings and think, oh, I can see why, you know, how this works. You know, how it's or she, the quest, the little band, group of friends, the hidden king.
Would Rider Haggard have been influenced by the man who'd be king, the Kipling story about that?
I think does he come first? I don't know. We'll have to look up. I'll go and do some research on this in the Bodleian Library.
Yes. Well, on that note,
we haven't quite got organised yet, but we are already thinking about the next live stream that we'll do, where we will talk about some individuals from history, their wider reputations wax and wane.
Well, actually, I mean, we are recording this on the day after the people who pulled down the statue of Colston in Bristol, they got acquitted in their trial. And basically the argument was, well, it had to come down because Colston was an evil man. But obviously for centuries, he was viewed as the great philanthropist.
Kind-hearted philanthropist, Tom, surely.
But in some ways he was.
Wow, I mean, this is very, this is my kind of territory, Tom.
But, you know, he his name was everywhere in Bristol.
Yeah.
And now it isn't. And so I think that's a very interesting launch pad to look at this.
Did a talk once with Peter Tatchell at the Colston Hall.
Oh, yeah, right. Did he object?
He didn't object, no, but he was actually spent most of his time talking about the Church of England. He has very strong, fierce views about the Church of England.
He's always kind of shouting at archbishops, isn't he?
Yeah, but he actually, it was a panel about 1968, and just completely randomly, halfway through the panel, Peter Tatchell started shouting about the Church of England, bishops, and homosexuality. And then it was like 15 years ago. It was like somebody flicked a switch and he went into this shouting session. And then it was like somebody flicked the switch again. He stopped and he said, yeah, back to the Grosvenor Square riot.
Maybe it was a bet.
Maybe. He doesn't strike me as a betting man, to be honest. Anyway, this is completely rambling nonsense now.
Anyway, but I think that's probably what we'll be doing. And we can expand on that.
Yeah, let's do that. It'd be really good fun.
Yeah. Maybe mention Henry V.
Yes. His reputation is still stellar, though, I think, Tom. Right. Thank you very much for listening. And we will see you for the next podcast and indeed for the next bonus podcast next week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.